See? He does exist. Roger, alcoholic.
Hey, Roger.
Tonight we're going to do a quick, like an overview of 4 through 9. In our step work, it's commonly referred to as the house cleaning. But the house cleaning isn't step 4, it's 4 through 9. That's how I clean the house, okay? So having defined the problem and the solution and made a decision in the third step to turn my thinking in the direction of that power, the first action that I take is a self-appraisal inventory. And they have me look at 3 areas: resentment, fears, and sex conduct, harmful behavior to other people. And they want me to get in front of some questions. So the thing that's nice about this is they give you really clear step-by-step questions to follow. Write down who you're mad at. Write down why. Write down how it affected you. Then write down, ultimately, how you reacted to that, okay? And the first time I do this at depth, I start getting a picture of how I see the world. How I see the world. And they give us some conclusions they came to that they want to talk to, they want me to come to. One is, do you see how you're living in the past all the time? And do you see also that whether it's real or imagined, it has the same weight? Whether I imagined correctly or not, if I believe it, it's the truth for me. One of the definitions of reality in the dictionary is anything that's believed. Okay? And then it gives me a conclusion they came to, which is, you know, we found that living in this resentment place leads only to futility and hopelessness. So it begs the question, is that the conclusion I came to? Then they said another thing that really kind of was disturbing, which is, have you noticed how these things that you've been planning to take care of and designing to get even with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, have you seen how those things have really dominated you? Spend a lot of time planning how I'm going to get even. Spend a lot of time how I'm not going to get found out and caught. Spend a lot of my life energy in that. And they say that's got to change, and then they give us a course to take to change that. Go ahead, Doug.
I'm Dennis. I'm an alcoholic. Well, it's good to be here after not being here for a couple of weeks. So I'm gonna kind of go back a little bit and kind of bring you current, kind of with my experience. Probably the first thing that I would like you to know, because it's important to me, it's part of my experience, I think it's part of Roger's experience, is that a lot of people come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not everybody gets the AA message. They get a lot of different things. And you heard Roger talking about some of that in the last couple of weeks. And that's kind of how my experience began. But at some point, I made one of the things that came back to me was an interest in reading. And so I read all of AA's literature, including the big book, and I discovered that what I was reading was not what I was seeing in my meeting. And for a long time, I had a resentment about that. I thought somebody was trying to shortchange me. But really, in an odd sort of way, they did me a favor, because realizing that, I realized that I couldn't depend on that group of people for finding the whole deal. I could not depend on them for that. I had to be responsible for that. I had to seek it out. I had to go to talk to people. I had to go to groups. I had to go to meetings. I had to go to conferences, listen to tapes. Whatever I had to do to get what I needed to get for my sobriety. So, like I say, in an odd sort of way, they kind of did me a favor, because it would have just been easy to come in, stay in that group, think the way they thought, do things the way they did, and wind up getting drunk and dying. And several of the people that I sobered up with, that's what happened to. So that's an important thing. Our sobriety is our own responsibility, and we have to go after it. Just the same way we went after the booze, same way we went after everything else, we have to go after it. So when we're at step 4, we've had some interesting experiences. You know, we've come in, I think as Roger mentioned, all of this discussion in the big book is in the past tense. So I've come in. I've come to an understanding that alcohol doesn't work for me anymore. It is no longer my solution. I may think it's my solution, I may think it'll do things for me, but the facts of the matter are that it will not. And I need to be willing to go to any lengths to stay away from it, to do whatever it takes to not get involved with it. Whether that means going out, standing on my head on the street corner, I need to be willing to do that. And my experience is, over time, that little experience, is kind of a reality check, you know. And the first time I had that kind of a reality check was when I realized my group wasn't doing it for me. So the question was I willing to go to any lengths to go wherever I had to go to get what I needed to get? And over a period of the years that I've been sober, time and time again, I've had that experience of, are you really willing to go to any lengths to resolve whatever situation you're in? And it's never easy, and it's never fun, but it's always necessary, I think. So that's the reality check. That our lives have become unmanageable. I missed that one entirely to begin with. I thought, okay, I'll just quit drinking, and now all my ideas will work. And then none of them did. But it took me a while to make that discovery. But I had to be willing to make that discovery. And that's really what it's about. Roger's spending a lot of time in the last couple of weeks talking to you about our thinking. And that's really what that gets at. It's, you know, you hear the phrase, what you see is what you get. Well, with us, it's what you think is what you get. What I think is what you get. Because that's the way I'm going to present myself to the world. That's the way I'm going to interact with you. You know, if I think you're out to get me, I'm going to be aggressive toward you. If I think you're my buddy, we're going to be friends. And reality has nothing to do with that. That's just my opinion on which I base my action. And I had to come to the point where I realized that I couldn't have a good idea about what reality was. I didn't have any idea about how life worked, about what I could and couldn't do, about what I should or shouldn't do, any of that stuff. And if we can come to that conclusion, second step's a piece of cake. It's an absolute piece of cake, because if we can come to that conclusion, we have to rely on something outside of ourselves. We absolutely have to. But again, it's a matter of seeking, which is number C in how it works. It's a matter of seeking. Am I willing to continually to seek to find the ideas and the path that works for me? Initially, it was a sponsor. You know, I came in and I went to my sponsor's house every night for 5 years. That's how I sought the program and sought my direction. But at some point, I had to move beyond that person. Not that they were irrelevant or that I shouldn't go see them or talk to them or any of that, but I had to place my reliance elsewhere, my total reliance. So that's a process of seeking. And then in the third step, which is really the big one, the question is, do I want to keep my old life and try to rebuild that, or am I willing to have a new one? And I haven't ever seen anybody been able to rebuild their old one. You know, you just can't. The foundation's gone. There's nothing to build on, because it's all old ideas. It's all prejudices, resentments, and all that kind of stuff. So we really have to start from scratch. And that's the interesting thing, and that's so important for me to understand when I get to step four. Because if I haven't reached a point where I'm just willing to let go of that old life and experience the life that I'm now going to be given, I can't do step four searchingly and fearlessly. It's just not possible. Because there's always going to be a part of my life that I don't want to look at. There's always going to be a part of my life, it says in the 12 and 12, I just as soon take to the grave with me. You know, and those kinds of things. But on the other hand, if I see that as a life that's going away, now I can be curious about what really was that about. It's kind of like, you know, after you get done watching a bad movie, it's painful while you're watching it. But a couple weeks later, you think, you know, I wonder, what were the good parts and what were the bad parts? And it's easy to do that because there's nothing attached to it. So that's really where we're at with step three, or where I was at, the point I had to come to. Was, that's not my life anymore. So, yeah, as long as it's not mine, I'm kind of curious how it worked or didn't, you know. And then I'm really able to look at it honestly, and I'm able to look at it fearlessly, and I'm able just to see what's there. But, again, that's not a, a simple, it's a simple process. It's just not a very pleasant one necessarily. So in step four, and I think Roger and I are both in of this school, that there's a lot of formats out there. You've probably seen many of them and heard about many of them. And, you know, the intent of the folks who put those together is probably very good. They probably personally had some very good experiences when they created that for themselves. But it really needs to be that kind of a process. The book just asks us to list things in a very simple way. And my experience is the fourth step was always complicated to me until I was willing to do it honestly, and then it was simple. So if you're looking at the fourth step and it looks complicated to you, then there are things that you're not willing to see, there are things that you're not willing to consider, there are things that you're not willing to do. It's just that simple. So you'll need to find those things within yourself that are kind of standing in the way. But once that's taken care of, then the fourth step becomes a pretty simple process. And it becomes, once I got to that point, my fourth step took about 45 minutes. You know, up to then, even the semblance of a fourth step would be a grueling 2-3 week process. You know, it just like had to drag me through the mud, you know. And when I was finally ready to do that, it was, oh, yeah, okay, well, I'll put that down, you know. And the other thing I'll say, and I'll turn it back over to Roger, is that that I've discovered anyway, when I'm doing a fourth step, and especially the first and second time maybe, when I'm doing a fourth step, there are always one or two things that don't fit on there, that don't fit into the description. And that's pretty common. It's pretty much been with everybody I've worked with. It's been my experience. And those are interesting things, because generally those are the things we want to take to the grave with us. And I'll just tell you a little story about one situation where a guy I was doing a fifth step with, actually, I asked, and it's part of what I do with the guys I do fifth step with, I asked for that. And he said, well, there really is one thing, but I don't want to talk about it. And so I repeated to him what it says in the 12 and 12, and that is, well, okay, but you're gambling. This is your life. And if you want to take the gamble that you can continue to hide that from yourself and others, you're betting your life on it. It's okay by me. It's not my life. And he said, well, I guess I'll tell you. You know, and he did. Now, the interesting thing about it is that it was not something that I would have considered in that category. It would have been easy for me to list, but for him it wasn't. But the interesting thing was that nothing specific or spectacular happened when he told it to me. However, about a week later, he got a call from somebody he was sponsoring, and the guy was literally incoherent on the phone. He it took him a while just to recognize the voice. He was so incoherent. And so I said, well, what did you do? And he said, I told the guy, hang on, I'll be over to your house in a minute. And he said, I was only 5 minutes away. So he said, I went over there. And he said, I walked in, and the guy was in a fetal position on the floor just crying and, you know, just out of it. And he said, I didn't know what else to do. So I told him the same thing I told you, that I didn't want to tell anybody. And I said, well, what happened? He said, the guy straightened right out. You know, so it wasn't the thing. It was the sharing of a secret, the sharing of something very personal that changed the whole equation, you know. And that's what we're getting to in the fourth step. When you read in the book, it asks us to kind of review what we've done in the fourth step a little bit after we're done with it. And it says it holds the keys to the kingdom. And that's the thing. You know, all of the stuff that I wanted to hide, that I didn't want to put in the fourth step, is the stuff that I need to tell you when I'm working with you. You know, it's a thing that connects us. It's a glue that cements us together, that allows us to survive together.
There was something that you said that is really true. You talked about the seeking quality. And one of the things that you'll find, and I'm sure everyone's had this experience already, is you get proportionally out of this thing what you put into it. If you do it half-assed, you get half-assed results. How do I know if I'm doing it half-assed? I'm discontented. My life isn't fitting. It's not working. I hear you guys making reports about what's happening. It's not happening with me. That's how I know. I'm restless and I'm irritable. And I'm discontented. Does that sound familiar? You know? That's the tell. I know. We have an emotional compass in here that tells us. And if you want more, you got to do more. So we start, they told us two important things before we got here. They said, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of the problem, and your main problem centers in your mind. It's attitudinal. It's how I see things. It's how I approach things. And so they start deconstructing for me how I approach things with this inventory process. And so they go through this resentment thing like we're talking about, and they say, here's our course. New attitude, new approach. Perhaps this person's spiritually sick. Bad, 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 bad. Treat them the way you would want to be treated, or a sick person, and on and on and on. And then always, the caveat always appears throughout this thing, don't argue, don't criticize. Stop that. Doesn't work. Makes more problems. And they say, that's how you start to outgrow resentments. Then they say, look at your fear. And when I got here, I had no fear. After I was here for a while, I was afraid of everything. You know, Dennis was talking about, it took about 45 minutes. Yeah, it took me about a year and 45 minutes, you know? It doesn't take long to do it. It's just a series of questions that require lists and prayers. It's not hard. It's not hard at all. So anyway, they have me look at fear, and they want me to conclude a couple of things. One, they say, where's your reliance? You know, I'm an atheist. I can tell you where my reliance was. That was a dumb question. Self-reliant or God-reliant? Look at every one of these things. Well, I don't have to look at everyone I know. No, look at every one of them. And that's one of the things. They're trying to get me to see what I've been trying to base my life on. This is the self-will part. This is the unmanageable part. When I manage my life and I apply myself, you know, that's what I get. I get this mess. I get this mess called my life. And so the conclusion in there is that I have placed my faith in the wrong place. We saw this in the chapter of the agnostic. Have the capacity for love, worship, and faith, just placed it in the wrong areas. Placed a complete faith in alcohol. And that was a false god. And eventually the false god will let you down. Whether it's money, power, prestige, sex, doesn't matter. Eventually it won't work. So it says, here's how you outgrow fear. Practice faith. So it begs the question, what's that concept I have in the third step? What is my concept of this power? What is it? And it just has to make sense to me. It could be a mystery. It sure as hell better not be a light bulb or an ashtray. Because that's too minimal. That's just too finite. It's got to be bigger than me. So therefore, the quality of that will be mystery, the unknowable. If we're talking about infinite power, infinite wisdom, infinite, then it's beyond what I can grasp. Thank you very much. So I start with the mystery. Here we go. You know, that's what I'm putting my faith in, the mystery. It's kind of feeble, but it's a start. It was an honest start. But I had to become an agnostic to do that. I had to move from atheism to agnosticism. Then I had to move to the willingness to believe in the possibility. And that was the minimal I could do to get over on that, and I did. And so my first concept was the steps, then it was the steps in this mystery thing, and it will evolve with your practice. It will evolve with your practice. Do you want to say something on fear?
Yeah.
Watch out for the public.
Well, there's a couple of thoughts, Kamini. One is just kind of a description of who you're dealing with here. you're dealing with a guy who is self-proclaimed atheist who didn't know enough about God to make that decision, and a self-proclaimed intellectual who didn't have enough in understanding of anything to make that kind of a decision. So, I mean, that's the kind of guys you got up front here. This whole four-step thing is really kind of interesting. But again, the whole idea of finding a power greater than yourself, one of the, Roger talked about the myths the first week here, and one of the myths I hear in AA is, well, just take your time with this higher power business. Take your time finding your higher power. Well, I got news for you. If I put you in an airplane with a parachute on your back and I throw your ass out the door and I say, take your time, pulling a ripcord, just get around to it whenever you feel comfortable. You know, what's your reaction going to be? That idiot's trying to kill me, you know? So, I mean, there is some urgency with finding a higher power here because that's where our power is going to come from. So until we make some beginning in that realm, you know, we're kind of in trouble. And it's probably one of the big things that I struggle with the folks I work with is everybody wants to take their time with that. And it's like, no, you need to start with a concept. Whatever it is, we got to have something. We got to have something to start from. We can't just be ambiguous about the whole thing. And then the other thing about the four-step listening things is, and it was part of my confusion with the four-step, and I see it in other folks. My thought was, well, it should be logical before I list it. It's like, no, that's just backwards. If it's logical, we might not even have to list it. Everything that's on there definitely is illogical to anybody with a sane mind. Of course, I wouldn't know that if it bit me, you know. So I just tell people, you know, put it down there. If it doesn't look like it makes sense when you're writing it, that's okay, because it's probably true. Now you're being restored to just a little bit of sanity, because now you can see that. The other thing is that I discovered a couple things. One is another thing that made the four-step difficult for me. I used to love the Minnesota Multiphasic Test, because I developed a pattern of I would read ahead in everything that every test I was given to kind of get a concept of what they were looking for, so I could give them what they wanted so they'd leave me alone. And I tried to do the same thing with the four step. You know, I tried to look ahead and what are they looking for? What are they trying to get out of me? And try to anticipate that. And you're never going to get it done if you do it that way, my experience. The only way I could get it done was literally, I mean, I've had to do this on some occasions, is take a piece of paper and put it on the big book and just literally force myself to read and do one line at a time. Just do what it says on that one line. And when I'm done with that, as much as I can, then I can move the paper and see what's on the next line. But I can't allow myself to read ahead in any kind of way. The other thing I discovered, because I was kind of wondering, why resentments, fears, and sex? I mean, why'd you pick those? There's all kinds of things you could make lists from. I got a guy who loves making lists, and I have to put him on list restriction. But why would you pick those? Well, I discovered an interesting thing about my experience, is we're working backwards. All of the things that I listed in the sex inventory, and when I say sex, I'm not just talking about intercourse. I'm talking about the whole relationship between men and women and all of that. All of the things that I had listed on the sex were the things that caused the fear, which were the things that drove the resentments. And so really, we're working backwards in that whole process. And I can't work forwards because it's too big. So I start with the small pieces. I start with the resentments. When I get done with those, then they begin to give me a sense of where my fears are. You know, just like it says, we move. A lot of the fears come up in there. So we move them over to the next sheet. Then I can list my fears. And then the sex part is usually pretty easy because it's stuff that's always on our mind anyway. You know, and then I can connect the dots after that. But this isn't a random thing we're doing. This isn't just somebody's a list we're making just because somebody thought it was cute and would be therapeutic for us. There's a real significant spiritual process that we're engaged in this whole thing, you know. And it's a thing that's really, like I said, going to be the glue that allows us to be together. It's a thing that's going to allow us to interact with life around us and begin to see life much differently. And it's the thing that's going to set us free. It's the thing that's going to set us free. It's the crap we've been dragging around that the committee has been working on overtime, you know. So we're going to take all this stuff the committee's been working on, and we're just going to deal with it this way. And then they won't have much to do, and so they won't have a lot to talk about. Unless we're slack, then, of course, we can generate a little material now and then. So it's a real significant spiritual process that we're engaged in, but it's hard to see that until after the fact. That's why when the book was written, they always talked about it in past tense, because the people who didn't do it never got to the past tense part, you know.
Yeah. A couple quick thoughts on fear. There's a line in our book that says, fear set in motion trains of circumstances we felt we didn't deserve, but didn't we set the ball rolling? What they're talking about there is the question, you know, when you're going across, every problem I have is when my instinctual demands smash into yours, okay? Instincts and collision is what Wilson described it as. I have a demand. I don't have a need or a want. I have a damn demand. Do you understand? This is what I want, and I'm going to get it. Everyone in here that's an alcoholic knows that. It's like, give an alcoholic a mission. It's a beautiful thing to watch, as long as you're not in front of them. But anyway, getting back to this idea of instincts and collisions, so the question becomes in the fear inventory, another way to peel this back is, did my need for emotional security create that fear? What part of self created the fear? Did my need for money, power, prestige, sex, did my ambitions, how I show up socially, did that create that fear? And you'll find that those instincts are always underneath that. The ego creates an appetite that says, we need this. And we need this about 5 minutes ago. And let's have at it. And then we go out chasing this need, and we end up creating a lot of harm. That would be distress, physical, emotional, mental. We hurt people. We don't always mean to, but, you know, we do. We hurt people. So they say the only solution for this is to practice the faith. I don't work on my fear. I work on my faith. Don't work on your fear. Don't work on your resentment. All we're doing is identifying them. Okay? And what this is doing is it's creating a deeper necessity in me to know and have a relationship with this power. Because as I go through this process, this is not a steam building. This is a steam dismantling. This is tearing apart the ego, getting it down to the sum total of, look at you. Whether it's resentment in the past, fear in the future, or your sex conduct, or the way you interact with people, it's always the same thing. You're selfish, you're inconsiderate, you're fearful, and you're dishonest. Regardless of the stimulus, regardless of the situation, regardless of what's a big thing, a little thing, it doesn't matter. That's my toolkit. I got those four things. That's where I come from. And it raises hell in my life. And I don't get it. And as I'm starting to uncover this, I'm going, holy moly. You know, you are a sick dog. You are really. But it was good news because they told me you're sick. You're not bad. I thought I was bad. I had no idea. You know, they refer to alcohol and our warped lives and all. I had no idea. So then they get us into sex conduct, which is one of the myths we're going to run into right now, which is, I'm sure you've heard this, well, you won't be in any relationships for a year. When you tell someone that, they go out and get in a relationship immediately. Immediately. It doesn't say that. I heard this in a meeting once, and I loved it. What do I have sex? Do I not have sex? Am I in relationships? Am I not in relationships? And they said, well, think of it this way. If you're going to overhaul a motor, it's a good idea to shut it down. Easier to do a valve job with the motor shut off. And now go, that's okay. And I'm trying to let this process work through me while I'm creating more of the very thing that I'm trying to heal from. Stop that. Just like you stop lying, you try and stop lying, you try and get new approaches. They said, you need a new approach in this area. I didn't have a very interesting sex inventory. It was exactly the same thing over and over again for about 25 years with different people. But it was exactly the same, different name, different year, exactly the same MO. And I looked at that and I said, son of a bitch. I was mystified. I couldn't believe it. But it was exactly, it was like when you answered the question, was it God reliant or self reliant? After about two of those, you're going, please. You know? And then you get in this sex thing and it's like, oh, geez. You know, I got bored with my sex inventory. I thought that was going to be exciting. And it says, look, you need to shape a new ideal, a new goal, something a little above heartbeat and pulse, you know, something a little higher than that, you know. And a lot of times we need help with this because I don't have a clue what a healthy ideal would look like. And then we have to be willing to grow towards that. It says, what if I screw up? Well, I'll tell you, I have screwed up. It says, if you have an honest desire to grow towards your ideal, and if you're honestly remorseful and you learn from the mistake, we don't necessarily think that you'll drink from that. Some do, but some don't. But we know this for a fact, and this is one of the places they promise us this. If I don't change and I have no remorse about the way I'm using people and hurting them, I'll drink. Period. Promise. Promise. Wait, Doc.
Well, the first thing I'll say is not in the book anywhere, and it's not anywhere in any literature. It's just my experience. And it's something I say to the folks I work with about this time, is there are really two ways to get rid of something. You can give it up or you can wear it out. The only difference is how much pain involved, you know. So the question really is how much pain do you want to have? And that's always true in my case. I wish it weren't, but it is. The other thing is, and it's really, I think, one of the hidden benefits, if you will, of the 12-step program that we have and the higher power that works in our lives, and that is that we really don't know how sick we are until we get better, which is really cool, because if at any given moment, if I knew how sick I was, I'd say to hell with it, you know. I'd say it's way too much for me to handle. I got to get out. And so, you know, a year from now or 5 years from now, I'll look back on tonight and I'll say, oh, my God, how did I even make it, you know? And that's been pretty much characteristically true. So in this fourth step that we're doing, that's the beginning of that process, the beginning of the awareness process of once I become aware of something, now there's possibility for change. If I got a wart on the end of my nose, as long as I'm unwilling to admit that, there's no chance I'm going to do anything about it. You know, it's only when I say, hey, I got a wart on the end of my nose, that I can make a decision whether I want to keep it or do something to get rid of it. But until then, I don't have any choices at all. You know. The other thing, when we get into the fear stuff that I usually talk to people about, because when people are working on their four step, they're chatting it up with other folks who are either working on their four step or have done it or whatever. But a lot of that chat tends to center around how they're feeling about things, you know. And so I spend a little time explaining something to them about emotions and alcoholics. And that is when I say to you, I'm afraid. You and I understand what that means, but if I say that to a quote-unquote normal person, I'm speaking Greek, because fear, what we consider fear, for them is terror, absolute terror. What we consider anger is rage for them. So we're a whole dimension off or in extreme from the norm, if you will. So that's why some of these things are so critical for our sobriety, is we sense them as fear and we sense them as anger, but really they're far more extreme than that, but we're so removed from the reality of our lives that we diminish them. But if we stick with the program and we practice the principles and the practices that are laid out in the book, we deal with those things even though we're not entirely aware of their full implication and of their full magnitude. So that's a great thing, because if I knew how rageful I was, I had a pretty good idea that when I got sober that my rage could overtake me and just rule me. I had a pretty good idea of that. But looking back on it now, I only really kind of had an idea about half. I mean, it was even far beyond that. It was so far beyond that, it's almost incomprehensible. So we have to have some faith in the process here. The other thing is that now we're getting ready for step five, and we're getting ready to share this information, okay? Now, here's another one of those. I'm not sure I'll call it a myth. I'm going to call it a misunderstanding, NAA, that it's really just a litany of woes, and I'm going to just kind of puke it all out in front of you, and we'll just mill around in it a little bit and say, God, that really stinks, and it's really gross, and we'll move on, and everything will be wonderful. And I haven't seen that work either. And the step says we found the exact nature of our wrongs. So what does that mean? You know, the nature of something is its core essence. Now, this is always amazes me whenever I bring it back into my consciousness. The nature of my wrongs in my fifth step is I'm afraid you're going to think I'm a wimp. Doesn't sound like a really big deal at all. But that thought runs through every decision I've made in my life. Every single decision has been based on trying to avoid you thinking I'm a wimp. And until I'm willing to say, hey, I may be, I may not be. Who cares? You know, but I have to own up to the fact that I've been running my life on that. And it's the same thing we've been talking about right along. It's what's going on between those ears, you know. I had a ex-father-in-law, that said at the breakfast table one time, God gave everybody brains. Some of them use them to think with, and others use them to keep their ears from slamming together. And apparently I was in the latter category, you know. But my whole focus has been on that. Now, you know, you're asking me to take this stuff and lay it out in front of another person. I mean, it's stuff I don't even want to look at. I'm supposed to lay it out in front of another person. So some interesting things have to happen here. Number one, I have to have enough faith in one other human being to lay that out there. So that's a big step. That's a really big step, you know. It's a leap of faith for most of us. But the other thing is that it's critically important, I think, and it's been true in my experience, that whoever I'm going to lay that out for and with understand what's involved in the process. It isn't a dumping ground. It isn't just a morbid examination of what I've done with my life. That there's a real process here. I'm looking for something specific. There's a process to this that I need to be engaged in and involved in. And so it ought to be somebody, number one, that has done this. And it ought to be somebody, number two, that understands where we're going with it. Because, again, my experience is the steps are cumulative in the sense that if I haven't done four, there's no way I can do five. That's obvious to a large degree. If I haven't done three, I can't do four, like I said, you know. So in five, if I can't do this in the manner intended, then everything beyond five is beyond me, which we see that in Alcoholics Anonymous. We see a lot of people, and you'll hear them in meetings. I mean, they get to five, and that's as far as they go. And they get lost, and they're back out there. And the other thing that I'll say, which is always kind of disappointing for people to hear, is I've listened as people come into AA, and everybody always has a fear of what would happen to them if they went back out drinking. And the interesting thing is that exactly what they're afraid of is exactly what happens to them. If I'm afraid that I'm going to be trapped in my own body and not be able to do anything, and I go back out and drinking, I know a guy like this, he's now quadriplegic, and he is basically trapped in his own body. And he's drinking booze through a straw when somebody can get it to him. If I'm afraid that I'm going to die, they get killed in a wreck or whatever, take their own life. So those fears that we listed, we can create. You know, we can create the result of if we don't, if we're not diligent about this. And I'm really a firm believer, and I talk about this with the folks in step three, is if you're not willing to go through this, we're going to stop this now, because you're going to get yourself in trouble if you play around with this. This isn't something to mess with or to do half-heartedly or just kind of do out of curiosity. We're serious here, you know. This is a serious deal. So we're getting ready to exhibit faith, you know. In three, it was basically an internal decision. There wasn't a lot of external evidence necessarily around that. But here's where rubber starts meeting the road. In step five, I got to talk to you about this, you know. And I have to have faith that you can help me see what's involved in this, see the patterns in my life, and see what happens. And last thing I'll say about this is that the principles in 4 and 5 I've used with a number of people in some pretty extreme situations. And last person I went through this with made an interesting comment when we got done. They said, you know, I have tried with therapists and counselors and clergy and spiritual advisors and all kinds of people to deal with some of these things. And I've gotten some relief, but nothing really seemingly permanent. And yet, when we went through this using the principles of 4 and 5, my whole perception of my life changed. And now not only do I not have the fear of that experience or having that experience again, I see it entirely differently, you know. And my response, and it wasn't anything that came out of my brain, it was just something that came out of my mouth, and I was as surprised as the person was when I said it, is that, you know, those folks, the professionals, have some very good services they can provide folks. And they can help us see the logic in man's world. But you and I can't survive with that. And so what the principles of 4 and 5 do is they help us see our experience in God's world, which is really where we live. And it's really the place we have to get to, that understanding of the place we exist. So it's a whole new reality. And and step five begins kind of a whole new reality check that we're going to do. And somebody has to lead us to that. An old timer, Clarence Snyder, used to say, you know, if you bought a new car and had never driven a car before, don't you think you'd go find somebody who knew how to drive to teach you? You know, and 4 and 5 are really kind of the same way.
I think your great fear of being a wimp was similar to one of the themes I had going in my life, which is if you know who I am, you won't like me. You won't want me here. You won't. It's a self-centered fear. The problem is self. Remember earlier in the book it said, get full knowledge of your condition. Try some controlled sobriety. Try some controlled drinking. Okay, we've done those experiments. Now we've decided to try the steps. And the inventory is giving me more knowledge of my condition. But I can't connect the dots, which is why this fifth step is so important. It doesn't say this in so many words in the book, but one of the things that I don't know the exact nature of my wrong. I think it's that I'm a liar. I think it's that I'm a bad actor. I don't know it's self-centered fear. I don't know it's this self thing. I understand intellectually the ideas. But when you sit down with someone that this is alive for and they can explain that to you, you have a much deeper understanding and appreciation of where you're standing and how hopeless. Now you know this idea of powerless and unmanageability is starting to take on new meaning, new texture, new intensity. Like, holy shit, I had no idea I was this bad. You know, and like Dennis said, if we knew, none of us would do this thing if we knew how sick we were. That's the grace of it. That's the grace of it. You know, whatever this power is that we end up hooking up with, mine has been very patient and very loving and kind, and it's not predicated on my flaws and my faults and how many mistakes I make. It's only the relationship is based on my willingness to grow towards this power. That's all. And it looks like I can have infinite do-overs as long as that's my goal. I can really screw up in a grand fashion and still be okay. I I mean, there's consequences and circumstances are created, but, you know, after you do that to yourself a few times, it's like hitting yourself in the head with a hammer. This really hurts. And someone suggests, why don't you stop that? Oh, shit, I never thought of that. You know, I never knew I could stop that. So I think in that fifth step, one of the things that I'm looking for is illumination. It doesn't say that in the book. But if I'm doing this with this guy or this woman that has this depth of experience, they should help me understand more clearly and more deeply the gravity of the situation. And then it's interesting. We take all this stuff out in 6 and 7 and give it to whatever this power is. It says good and bad. Take it all. This is commonly referred to as the third step with teeth. Oh, this is what you meant by decision. Holy moly. You know, and so I've got this all collected in little bags, resentment bag, a fear bag, and a sex conduct bag. And they say, now you've talked to someone about it. You've displayed it to God and yourself. You've gotten a level of honesty and hopefully some insight. Now take it out to the curb and leave it there, and God will take care of it for you. That's what I do. And it asks me some questions. It says, have you been thorough? Which is why we spend so much time on the myths in the first three steps, because it's the foundation of all the work you're going to do. Powerless, unmanageable, willing to believe in the possibility of this power or believe in the power. Make a decision to turn your thinking, your actions in the direction of that power. Start rowing. There you go. And then you do the fourth step, you do the fifth step. Now you've done all this quote-unquote work, and now you go back inside with 6 and 7 and you reflect inward. And you go, well, here, give it all. And it says, have you been thorough? In other words, have you done the first 5 steps to the best of your ability? It says, is there anything you still cling to? I just kind of blew by that. But there were things I still was clinging to. Sex and money. Just a couple little things. Really not anything too significant. And I didn't have an awareness of that. I just lied about it. I just pretended it wasn't there. Because I knew the right answer. I knew the right answer. Yes. Oh, yes. Take it all. Hallelujah. You know. And then go act like a frickin' horse thief. So we've created an exercise for that. It says, if there's something you still cling to, pray for the willingness. That's all. It doesn't say you can't continue. It says pray for the willingness. To what? To have it removed. By what? A power greater than yourself, because obviously you got no power to let go of this thing. When I've done that prayer, it intensifies the heat. Things don't get removed until I let go of them. And the amount of pain and discomfort I'm willing to endure while I'm getting ready to let go is astounding. It's just like, you're kidding me. No, I'm not kidding you. I don't want this anymore, but I cannot let go of this. I must want it, I guess, and it goes on and on. So I consign all of this stuff to this power, to this idea. And then I move on. Go ahead, Doc.
I love 6 and 7. I would call them the working steps, because everybody that I know that's involved in 6 or 7 are saying, I'm working on, and yeah. I want to go, not around me. Because I can guarantee you, anything that I've ever worked on has gotten worse.
Yeah.
I give it power, and it just grows. It's just absolutely miraculous the way it grows, you know. Have you ever wondered why there's not a lot of time spent in the big book on 6 and 7? You know, I mean, there's a chapter on each in 12 and 12, but there's not a lot of time spent on 6 and 7 in the big book. That's for a very good reason. There's only 2 simple decisions we need to make. One is, I don't know what's good or what's bad. The prayer for that, step 7, implies that. I have no way of knowing what's good or what's bad. And the best example in my life is, I was always a shy kid. And so when I came into AA, I thought, well, that must be a character defect. I should be outgoing like Roger, you know? And it's like, no, that's not what I should be. That's not my makeup. I enjoy sitting back and watching folks, and I'll interact with the ones I'm familiar with and that sort of thing. So, but the other thing is, if I'm outgoing like Roger, when I'm new, I'm going to be lipping off to everybody, you know? Which means I got a lot of ground to cover later on, cleaning all that up. Now, being shy was an advantage because I wasn't doing it. I might have been thinking it, but I wasn't saying it. So it was. It really turned out to be an asset.
You were writing it.
Well, I was doing some writing. But, but my point is that we really don't know, you know. And I recently saw something from Steve Jobs, the top dog at Apple, and he gave a talk not long ago on the three things in his life that when they happened seemed like the biggest disasters of his life. One was he dropped out of college, then he formed Apple. Then it was the Apple board kicked him off, then he formed Pixar, and that became a great deal. And then he got sick, and out of that came the iPod. So all of the things in his life that were tragedies, seemingly tragedies, when they happened, took him to a better place, you know. And really, that's our experience if we can incorporate what 6 and 7 is trying to get us to do, is to give up that idea of right and wrong, good or bad, best and worst. And some of those words, for me, I had to just literally make a commitment to myself just not to use them, because it changed the way I thought. If I think about doing something and doing the best I can, I think about it differently than if I think about doing it right. Okay? If I think about doing it right, I think about perfection. If I think about doing it to the best of my ability, I think about progress. So I give those words give me a whole different perspective when I use them in my own thinking. So that's the first thing we're asked to do. The second thing we're asked to do is just take direction. You know, just take direction, which is really difficult for us, because cooperation to a drunk like me feels like failure. If I cooperate from you, what's going on between these ears is, well, you're better than I am, or I'm wrong, you're right, or that kind of thing, that kind of hierarchy kind of thing. And I got to give that up because it doesn't work for me. It just doesn't work for me. So if I'm willing to follow direction, it becomes very, very simple. If I don't know what's good or bad, and I'm willing to follow direction, my whole life changes. Because now, instead of seeing things as attacks on me, as tragedies for me, that kind of stuff, all I see is, what can I do next? What's my next thing, you know? Where can I take action? Where can I not take action? And life gets very simple. And I discovered that watching a couple little dogs that we had. You know, I was just all really worked up one day and was trying to meditate my way out of that and couldn't quite get that working. And these two dogs kept running across in front of me in the living room. And so I figured, well, what the hell? I might as well just watch them. This doesn't seem to be working. And I watched them really closely, you know. And when they were hungry, they ate. And when they were tired, they slept. And when they were thirsty, they drank. And when they had to go to the bathroom, they let me know to go outside. And never once did I catch one of them eating, looking like he was wondering whether he should be outside crapping. You know, never once was there one trying to go to sleep, but he couldn't quite do it because maybe he thought he should be over drinking water, you know. Whatever was in front of them to do, they just did. They simply responded to life. And that's really the thing that is the biggest joke on us of all. And that is that we're given a life to experience, but our perception is we got to run it. You know, we're given a great life to have, to experience the benefits of it and the beauty of it, and we think we got to make it happen. And probably one of the worst places in sobriety where that comes into play is we think we have to make our sobriety. And people are always, always disappointed when I tell them you cannot. It is absolutely impossible for you to accelerate your sobriety. The only thing you can do is retard it. And you retard it by trying to make it happen. You know, it's just let it happen, experience it, go with it, and do the best thing you can with it. And life becomes a lot easier.
So, We have subjected our ego to a huge deflationary process. We come in, we surrender in the first step, and 2 through 7 is about letting the air out of the bag that is me. And we've gotten in front of a lot of our thinking, a lot of our attitudes, a lot of our old ideas, enough to be mightily impressed. And we've had some help getting more impressions from this fifth step. And now we've consigned this all to God. And it's interesting at this point, because the next phase of our development is restitution. Okay? And it's interesting because what happens there is, it talks about how we go to these people. We don't have to go crawling and sniveling and humiliated, embarrassed with our heads down. We can go with our heads up, not because we're arrogant or self-confident, but because we're God-powered. This is the whole deal. The results are not mine in the amends. The results are God's. The effort is mine. And we talk about this quite extensively in the big book studies and stuff that we do, but this is about how I've harmed you. This is not an apology. This is how I've harmed you. And we have to be really careful that when we do this, we don't create more harm in doing it. And guilt, shame, remorse are great motivators, but if they're not focused, I'll end up doing things with you that I'll call an amend that'll just create a situation that is much worse than before I did the amend. So the caveat is be cautious and seek guidance. Talk to people that have had this experience. How did you deal with that? How did you apply these principles to that, and what was the outcome? Now, you tell me how you did that. And your sponsor should be able to aim some people at you. You go to your home group, you hear people talk, and you'll start to know, how did you get through that? How did you do that? Seek a lot of different takes on this thing before you pull the trigger, because once it's out of your mouth, it's done. You cannot take it back. You cannot fix it. The idea here is to mend, to make whole. If I come over to your house and I have a little problem steering in your driveway and I break your fence, fence is broken, I mend it. It is now mended, fine. The fence has been restored to the condition it was before I broke it. That's what I'm trying to do with this process with you. Before I harmed you, I'd like this restored, but I can't restore it. If it's going to be restored, God will have to restore it. So it's a beautiful thing, because now your response to me is not predicated on me getting free. I don't need you. I don't need your forgiveness. I don't need your understanding. Be nice, but I don't need it to be clean, to be okay with this. I can get free regardless of your response. I'm not doing it for your response. I'm doing it to get honest with my behavior and how it's affected other people.
Roger mentioned old ideas, and I just want to touch on that for a minute. I don't get a lot of new guys to work with anymore. I get a lot of guys who are in the teens in sobriety. And generally, one of the conversations we have is, so do you find yourself doing things you don't want to do, but you don't know why? And the answer is always yes. And so I say to them, so what are your old ideas? And they say, what? And I say, well, what are your old ideas? Well, I don't have any old ideas. I said, well, you must, because you're operating on them, but you don't know why. You know, and the point is that some of that stuff is so ingrained in us that we really can't see it until we almost have to reverse engineer it, in a sense. And that's kind of what we're engaged in here, is a little bit of reverse engineering to find out kind of how this thing works that's inside us. So why do you think, you know, when I looked at the steps and in my brilliant mind, I thought, well, why wouldn't you do 8 and 9 up front and kind of get the heat off, and then you'd kind of have a little time to work on some of this other stuff, you know? Well, the truth is that until I do all the things prior to 8 and 9, I'm really not in a good position to do that because of a couple things. Number one, I don't know what I did. And number two, my intent is to get the heat off, so I'll make any promise to you that I need to make for you to be happy or for you to be content, or for you to get the heat off, kind of what Roger's talking about. And that's just backwards from what we're trying to do. So we've gone to this through this process to give us a sense, number one, of just being honest with ourselves about who and what we are. And two, realizing that this is really out of our control. It's entirely out of our control. All we can do is take the actions, but the results, we can't predetermine them, you know. And again, thoroughness is really the key here. I've made amends a couple different ways. I made amends early on to my creditors the wrong way, or I should say, not according to the directions. And the fact, all I was really doing was lying to them. It was the ego that was involved in trying to make me look better, trying to get the heat off. You know, so I was making promises I couldn't keep, either out of fear or guilt or desire to impress somebody. And didn't work. And then later on, once I had actually practiced the steps, I came at it from a whole different thing. And the whole different perspective was, for example, with my ex-wife. For a long time in sobriety, when I drive through the county she was in, I'd get pissed off just because she was there, you know. And I made the mistake of telling my sponsor that one day, and he said, "Have you made amends to her?" And I said, "No, and I have absolutely no intention of doing it either." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "Because she'll use that information against the kids, you know, about me against the kids." And he said, "It's none of your business what she does with it. It's absolutely none of your business. Question is, are you willing to make amends?" So this was on a Wednesday, and I said, "Well, fine, I'll make amends," because I only saw him once a week, you know, and I figured he's kind of an old guy, and the time I see him next week, he'll forget, you know. And but I actually wound up doing it. The amazing thing was that yes came out of my mouth with no intention of mine of saying yes, and the other thing was that I actually went through it with no intention of going through it. You know, so be careful what you say yes to, because God may hold you to it, you know. But looking back on it, the interesting thing about it was that I realized that it was more than just going to her and saying, "I'm sorry I swore at you. I'm sorry I called you names. I'm sorry I slapped you around. I'm sorry." It was more than just doing that. I mean, I had to own up to the fact that I did those things. There was no question about that. But there was more to it somehow. And I finally realized that really what I had done with all of those things was I'd stolen her dignity. I'd stolen her dignity from her. And that sounds like I think I'm powerful, but that's not true. It's really kind of a form of brainwashing, really. Because no matter how well you think of yourself, if I say to you every day, "You're worthless," at some point you're going to begin to question that. And at some point, you're going to be willing to believe me. You know, well, that's what I'd done to her. And so when I went to her, that's what I had to make amends for. And I had then to be willing to say to her, I will create the conditions wherever I am so that you can reclaim your dignity. I can't do it for you. Your sense of self is going to have to, you'll have to do that yourself. But I'll create an environment where I will support that. You know, it's kind of like Roger's example of the fence. You know, I knock down the fence. I'm willing to put whatever I can forward to redo the fence. But I can't do the fence, your fence, on my property. It's got to happen on your property, so you have to participate in it. But I have to be willing. And the other thing that makes it so important for me to know who and what I am when I go to make these amends is that if I don't, I'm going to feel guilty at some part in that discussion process. It's just a natural thing. And I'm going to start trying to say things and do things to absolve the guilt, the sense of guilt. And I'm going to make commitments that I can't keep. I'm going to make commitments that I ought not make that are not good for you or me. And I'm going to get both of us in trouble. So if I have a better sense of what I am doing, who I am, and where the power comes from, when I go to do that, I'm in a much better position. Number one, to know what I'm willing to do going in and what I can agree to and what I can't and what my responsibility is and what I'm actually trying to restore.
you hear how fear is showing up in all this? And one of the things that we're doing here, when we looked at our resentments, we found the fear in that. We looked at our fear, we found the fear in that. Looked at our harmful behavior to others, we found the fear in that. Went to the fifth step, what was the fear there? Oh, God, you're going to think I'm a wimp. You're not going to like me. It's the fear all the time. It's the fear. Now I'm in this amend process, and I'm going, what's the fear now? The fear is all of this stuff that I've done, all my bad acting. I'm afraid. It says I must be free of the fear. So I got to be able to walk down the street and not worry about running into you, not worry about money I owe people, not worry about the internal revenue, not worry about the bikers looking for me. I can't live in the fear. And this is a process that I can incrementally get free of the fear. The other piece of this is, implied in this, is I'm willing to change the behavior. If I make an amend to you about lying, I'm making an amend to myself that I am going to discontinue lying globally, not specifically with you, but with everyone. Because I don't want to tell you, lied, here's the deal, blah, 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 and then have to tell you the same thing in a month, or come back to you in 3 months and say, you know that thing about the character assassination? Well, it's back again. So I just want you to know I straightened it all out. And all I'm telling you is I haven't changed. I'm telling you that my amends is worthless. In the fellowship, a lot of times this gets trivialized. Say amends. Why don't you quit behaving like that? Stop it. And when I'm working with guys, if we get to the amend and I go, now, are you willing to change that behavior? Oh, yeah. I mean with everyone across the board. If the answer is no, I say, well, then let's wait. Let's do another one. Because it's not okay to get right with you and still be a liar. That's missing the point. It's not okay to stop stealing from you and still be allowed to steal from you. I'm stealing from bigger people that really don't miss it. You know, I mean, I can't live that way. We're out of time, right?
Yeah.
You want to close with anything?
No.
All right, so anyway, this was really thumbnail-y sketchy, but you get an idea of the dynamics and the principles in this process. And next week, we're going to talk about moving into the now, 10, 11, and 12, because we're being fashioned through this process to have a message to carry. It's AA's message of changed life. Changed life. Central fact of our lives. Found a power. Hooked to that power. And it's transformed the way we see everything and the way we interact with everything. Who knew? See you next week.